welcome to a very special episode of Lab Talk.
Hi, everybody. My name is Ben Putley. I am the CEO and co-founder at Alchemy. Welcome back to a very special episode of Lab Talks. It's my pleasure today to be joined by Rao Pal, the CEO and co-founder of Real Vision. Rao, I think for those of you that may not know who you are, it'd be great to kind of get a brief introduction to you, Real Vision, and kind of your story so far.
Sure. So my story is like 35 years of financial markets. I was grew up in the UK. I was at Goldman Sachs, where I started and ran the hedge fund sales business in equities and derivatives. I then went and ran a global macro hedge fund for GLG Partners, who was the largest hedge fund firm in Europe, back in the early 2000s. Then opted out of the rat race, moved to the Mediterranean coast of Spain to get out of that miserable English weather.
And
started writing macro research called Global Macro Investor, which I still write 20 years later, which is kind of a high-end research service for the world's biggest hedge funds, family offices, sovereign wealth funds, that kind of thing. As part of that journey, where I kind of analyzed the global economy and global economic trends and global markets, I managed to get the financial crisis right and then the European debt crisis right. And it was over that period that I realized how screwed the entire economy was because of how much debt there was out there, and that nobody actually owned anything in the financial system, whether it was bank account, because in Cyprus they took all your money, or whether it was Lehman Brothers, where nobody owned the collateral. And I thought, you know, I should do something about this. And that ended up in a long journey of me trying to start a bank anywhere in the world, the world's safest bank. It was going to be not fractional reserve banking. We ended up getting the chairman of the FDIC to be our chairman. We were buying a bank in Texas, and we went to the Dallas Fed, and they said, "This is a brilliant idea. We'll never give you a license." I'm like, "Why is that?" They're like, "Because you'll take all the deposits." So I wrote about it in GMI. It's like, wow, this was shocking, because it was true. Somebody said, this is 2012. Somebody said, well, you need to look at Bitcoin. So that started my crypto journey, where I realized that was the answer. I then also, as part of that whole period, people would come up to me and said, why didn't we know what was going on? You know, friends of my parents, friends of friends, everyone lost money. Half my friends in Spain went bankrupt. And I'm like, yeah, we're not doing a good job of really democratizing the information that's held within the hands of a few. So we started Real Vision, which was the world's first kind of long form media platform. That's how we started, without a full kind of platform for investors in a number of different ways. So that's been that journey. Also, I've got an asset management firm called Exponential Age Asset Management that invests in crypto hedge funds to try and capture the trend of what we're at, $4 trillion market cap today in crypto. I think it goes $100 trillion. So that's a way of capturing that mega trend. And in addition to that, I'm also on the board of the Sui Foundation.
How we got put in touch, I think, was our shared love of Sui. It's a pretty impressive bit of kit. And I know you've talked a lot about the tokenization of everything, and I assume that's how you kind of support your thesis to $100 trillion market cap. But I'd love to dive into that a bit more. Like, what do you think are the key triggers that take us from the $4 trillion where we are today up to the $100 trillion in the future?
Well, this is an inverse model to anything we've seen before. So retail drove the thing from start, which was fascinating. And then the financial system. I've always said, and I've been saying for a decade, we can front run the institutions. And we had basically 10 years to front run them. Now they're coming. Regulations change. They're coming. And they're coming in the financial sector first. So stablecoins, it's a way of the US broadening its reach of the dollar, but it's also a way of financing the debt, which is a huge problem, still remains the biggest economic problem to date. And then on top of it, blockchain rails are just more efficient for settlement, instantaneous ownership. This decentralized ledger is extremely useful for the financial system. Things like NFTs work really well for things like derivatives, because those are just contracts and we can turn them into smart contracts. So that's the financial system, and that is now igniting and starting its journey. So the next 5-10 years will be all of that moving to blockchain rails. But there's vast parts of the economic engine that are that is based on the internet, that really the blockchain, if you think of the blockchain as a different way of organizing the internet itself. So there's value that gets transacted. There are contracts from everything, from tickets to whatever it may be, that exist that are more efficient on blockchain rails. You create a world where not only do you read and write, which is the internet, but you own it as well. So you own your own data, and you have the transparency of what blockchain does. So that is what I think the market is not focusing on. They're talking about tokenizing real world assets like houses and whatever. Great. The reality is digital ID is probably the biggest use case of all outside of money. In an AI world, we've got massive applications to come out of a number of different areas, and one of them is the area you're working on as well. Just anything that gets transferred on the internet can be done in this way.
I completely agree. I think that the advertising has been the way that the internet has largely been funded to date, and I think that I share the same sentiment as you in saying that currently that system is particularly broken. I wonder, where do you think it's broken? I know you've mentioned this on the past, but I'd love to kind of really dive into that. That is very close to my heart. So
yeah. So the advertising model for me is broken on many, many levels. One, it's purely extractive of our attention.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, in exchange we get free services. Okay, but the power with which that attention is concentrated in the hands of a few corporations is simply staggering. You know, how much information Google has on us all is beyond anybody's comprehension. People, you know, are fighting like governments that we shouldn't give them our information. I'm like, you have no idea. My Google Nest knows which room I'm in at any stage, when I'm on holiday, what time I sleep. Your Roomba tells you exactly the dimensions of your house. I mean, it is unbelievable how much information they have. And how they monetize that is through advertising.
I agree. I think that people would sooner give people access to their phones to see what messages they've sent than their Google search history, because it's it feels anonymous to some degree. But as you rightly say, it's certainly not. I think that's why people often think that their phones are listening to them. Really, no, they've just Googled it. And then it's appeared in the feed somewhere as an ad at some point in the future.
Yeah, I'm still actually not sure about the listening thing, because I noticed things that, we all notice it. So there's something going on, and you know, generally you don't mind, but we're going to move into a world where AI is going to capture a lot of the value chain of human work.
Yeah.
So where is our role in this?
Mm-hmm.
We need to get paid for our attention. And so my view is that somewhere between your digital ID and what happens with advertising, that you have to share the revenue directly with the people. Now, YouTube do it a little bit if you've got your own YouTube channel. Twitter does it if you're, you know, if you're a super node on the network and you're got attention. But there are many other ways of which we can earn a living ourselves for our attention. That's kind of interesting. I know we saw it with Brave Browser with the basic attention token.
Yeah.
Interesting start. So that's one part of the advertising industry. Well, we'll talk about that part, and then we'll talk about the murky world of plumbing as well.
Yeah, I think I would challenge you to some degree on the payment of attention, because it's something that I've thought about a lot. And I think that it makes a lot of sense for you and I as individuals that view ads on the internet. But I think, like, when you think about the cost of advertising online. So we deal with a lot of big brands, and they will spend, let's say, $5 to $10 for 1,000 ads online. If you and I were to share part of that, we would have to be watching 1,000 ads, some description, with the current system as it is, which is no good for the brand. And then really you're going to get a share of $5 to $10, which isn't going to move the needle. But in some regions where it might move the needle, the purchasing power is less, so then the reward is lower. And that I'd never really understood quite how the economics might actually work for that.
Yeah, because what they're paying for is a success rate that is low. So what you've got, so conversion rate is very low from an online app.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you have high quality information about me and you serve me ads directly of which are valuable to me, your conversion rate is going to go through the roof. Mm-hmm. So in which case you're going to pay more for that because it's higher quality lead, but you'll probably still save money as a brand because you're better targeting. And so therefore, will I be sharing a fraction of $5 or being sharing a fraction of $1,000? I don't know.
Yeah.
But you know, if you think about how much time we spent online in a year, does that add up to a few $1,000s? Or, you know, if you're an intense user of the internet, could you make $10,000 a year? Great. It's not a living, but it's a way. It's kind of like if you think about adding solar back to the grid.
Mm.
You're participating in a network of which you get economic value, which is they buy the excess energy from you.
Yeah.
Right. That's how I think about it. I don't think of it as like, oh, the advertisers are going to make us rich. No, it's not going to happen.
Yeah, we quit.
Baseline income or cash flow. Okay, that's interesting. Because we are, in the end, I think we're moving towards more network states, and therefore nodes in the network who add value need to get economic incentivization. And that can be via tokens, which I think is the optimizing principle for larger networks. I think that works well.
Yeah. That is an interesting view on it. I think particularly as AI agents proliferate, you may well have more agents speaking to each other rather than actual human beings being involved with advertising.
Yeah, so if you think about that for a second, if you go to an advertiser who goes to X, right, there's probably now, I don't know the numbers and nobody will admit it, but let's assume it's like 30%, 40% agents now.
Yeah.
Or bots in one way, shape or form.
I would say so, yeah.
Then you're, as an advertiser, your CPMs just keep diminishing. And we've seen that over time because the quality of who you're advertising to keeps diminishing. We saw the same with, you know, a huge rise of let's say, India on the internet. Mm-hmm. So you might target a person on the internet, but if they're from India, actually their propensity to spend because of the average income is lower, but they're probably going to be in the next few years the largest English speaking part of the internet.
Yeah.
So it becomes an issue for brands. And, you know, having gone through this myself, the other thing that happens, you know, when we get to the murky world of advertising is you get click farmed to death.
Yeah.
And brands get abused. I mean, that's a real issue. So I'm not looking at it from, hey, brands are abusing us as people. I'm thinking everybody's getting abused in this system, and a more direct peer-to-peer way of doing it actually solves a lot of problems.
I certainly agree. There's a number of large businesses that do ad verification, and they will simply return to you, was this ad seen by a human being, yes or no? And then when you push them on how exactly that was determined, they are very pensive about telling you how exactly that was determined, because if we tell you, you'll be able to figure it out, and then so would anyone else, but we're still going to charge you a dollar CPM. So it's kind of like, to some degree, almost mafioso, in that you're paying for protection and you're not really necessarily sure what the benefits are, other than it's on a plan, someone's happy that it's on a plan, and then the money continues to flow.
I mean, I can tell you something that I've never really talked about, or not for a long time, is when Real Vision started, Google came to us and said, look, you guys are really interesting. I'm going to work with you.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to help you with ads. You know, give us a budget. At the time, it was a huge budget for us. We barely launched. It was like, give us $250,000. It's going to take you 3 months and we'll prove to you how effective it can be. We went through the entire $250,000, didn't move the needle at all. And when we broke down where the traffic was coming from, look at all these views you're getting on your ads, etc. They were all farms. And this was coming direct from Google themselves. I'm like, this is exploitive of everybody.
It certainly is. I think, like, the people that are creating content online, I think particularly what were magazine and newspaper publishers that kind of became the first content sites, they weren't necessarily sure about the internet and probably had the exact same conversation that you have with Google, where it's like, okay, we can just monetize that for you. And then before they knew it, kind of dealing with the new technology in the internet, and then when mobile phones came around, dealing how that then changed how they publish content and how it looked and what did you write and where did you write it. Before they knew it, they'd kind of given the keys to the kingdom, and it was very difficult then
to get them back, people still use Google's ad server. I've used it for many years. It's not particularly user-friendly, but it's just like fully entrenched now. And
it's ubiquitous. It is this.
And they're not all technology companies. You know, like I spent some years working at News UK, and it's unusual that you work for a company that kind of spans hundreds of years of technology still every day. You know, like they have print, radio, TV, and then digital. It's like that's what 200 years of technology that they still work on every single day. And it's tough to spread resources across that effectively. Like some is counterintuitive to other parts of the business, and you have often people that are selling multiple parts of the same person. It's just like, I do feel for people that are creating content, because there's a lot of people that have taken advantage of them for a long time.
You said something interesting that's just triggered a thought in my head. You said like magazine, right? Now imagine if you had a high-end magazine like Wallpaper or whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
And that magazine gave you an NFT when you subscribe. And now they can kind of look at your social graph and figure out who you are. You can give some basic details. If you give some basic details, maybe in a zero knowledge proof format embedded in the NFT, then maybe the magazine can share the advertising revenue, because the advertising revenues go up because you've got more information about your audience, and they then accrues to your NFT. So you're now becoming empowered as a node in the network, because they're saying, we value your attention for the advertisers. We will share some of that. Maybe the subscription cost has to go up a little bit to counterbalance. So there's going to be a weight. And now you've got readers who are part of the economic engine of what the success of that is. Okay, now you've got something interesting.
Yeah, certainly. I think, and then even if you weren't necessarily a paid for user, I think that human beings tend to prefer free. I think some pay for value for certain things. You're like, you're willing to pay for a Financial Times subscription because there's interesting content that you'd have there. But I think for those that are still free, you know, that becomes a very interesting identifier that is anonymous by nature, but actually has a lot of interesting information that might be, if you were using that wallet elsewhere, it might have certain cryptocurrencies that you held, or other NFTs that you held, or other dApps that you'd interacted with, that allowed you to create an interesting picture about the behaviors of that individual. And then you would be able to categorize them, show them more relevant ads. And I think people don't mind ads so much if they're not intrusive or it's stuff that is highly relevant. It's just when it's, you've seen your 100th monday.com ad on YouTube, it starts to get a bit sick in it, because you know you're still going to move to monday.com.
So that's what Web3 enables. It enables that side of the equation. When you own your attention in some respects, or share your attention, or permission your attention, now everybody can win. The newspaper or whatever, or YouTube or whatever it is, can win. You win. The advertisers win. I mean, nothing wrong with that. I think everybody would be happy if it happened.
There's another frame I want to put to you, which is one of the things that SWE has made available for Alchemy. And it's in now operating Alchemy for 4 years. We have been at the behest of quite extended payment schedules from large corporations to small corporations. And I think what a very robust, performant, high-speed layer one like SWE does, we're now, I think they've just topped $2 trillion of TVL, so like quite deeply liquid. You create the potential for people like you and I that might have some liquidity to actually put that on chain and allow for publishers who are waiting often 60, 90, 180 days for payments to actually draw down from a pool and receive that capital at 0 days in exchange for a fee.
It's just crowdsourcing factoring. Factoring has been how the world has worked because of cash needs, instant cash needs versus payment times. Because everyone manages that, and there's a margin to be made in the middle, which is interest for lending money. Now, that was always a centralized system, and now you can crowdsource factoring at scale. So, great. Yeah, invoice financing. Fantastic.
That's literally it. Yeah, we've given it a sexier name. Let's call it AdFi, because I think that often DeFi is looking for a source of sustainable yield, and I think that the $750 billion ad market is a great place for that, and it's never kind of truly been financialized as such. You know, like it's traded like a financial asset, You know, you have auctions that happen in real time. People are bidding. You have, I guess, like very, very short expiry auctions, which are like the ad units themselves. And then the highest price wins. I think it's just then all of the reconciliation about a SAT off chain. We're kind of helping that come on chain. And I think now you don't need to trust Google or Meta or any exchange that isn't notarizing transactions on chain. Say, I've earned this. I want to finance this. Can I finance this platform? Yes, you can. And then kind of, even if it's a mom and a pop blog, you know, like it might be that they can get some money to go out for dinner. Or if, even if it's a large corporation, you're like talking about opening up free cash flow on a balance sheet, which can be significant as far as like corporate development is concerned. So yes.
I mean, ads are a massive commodity that are traded online in vast scale. People have no understanding.
Yeah. Unbelievable, yeah.
The mirror financial system that is going on, much also like things like shipping are as well, freight contracts, it's all the same, and they all require funding and they all have the same issues. But the velocity and speed and size of the advertising industry is something people don't understand. The fact that high-frequency trader firms like Virtue and others are involved in this market, because it's very murky, it's not regulated.
Yeah,
the spreads are egregious. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of arbitrage. There's a lot of manipulation that goes on. Yeah. And you know, you and I have talked before about this. It's like a friend of mine used to run The Guardian, and the spread between what Unilever paid for an ad and what The Guardian received, 70 to 80% was lost.
Yeah.
Somewhere in the middle. And they're like, this is insane.
Yeah.
And that is a huge problem for the system itself. Yes, there is the reason you lose a lot is because those people are providing liquidity, but we don't need centralized liquidity. We can use decentralized liquidity. And then we can all participate. And what we'll see is the system becomes, the spreads narrow, the system becomes more efficient, everybody participates and gets yield out of it.
Exactly right. I think you've hit the nail on the head. That's exactly what we believe at Alchemy. It's that there is no, I mean, there's up to, I mean, 8 middlemen that can be involved in the buying and selling of ads online, you know, and that goes from like the brand to the media agency, to the buying platform, to the exchange, to the ID provider, sell side platform. Like it's funny because the industry's been like misdirected to some degree because it tends to be around like advertising standards. So like, don't advertise, I don't know, vapes to kids. And that is like almost a misdirection, whereas actually like the pricing is not normalized. It's hard to even get like a public feed as an oracle of like the live pricing of digital ad markets, which it's traded in the same way, but it's really just archaic in comparison to anything else you trade in that exact same way. It's like for a long time, we've been thinking that this is such an obvious problem to solve. It's just taken, it takes a while to get people to buy into it. You know, I think that the winds are
still. Yeah, I mean, I've looked at this for a long time and realized the scale of the issue. And it, you know, and I've mentioned in the past, it's obvious that it's going to go on chain. It has to. It's too opaque. It's too inefficient. Mm. And it's serving nobody except a few firms in the middle. It's and that is the issue. And actually, advertising could be turned into a public good by us all participating as well. So there's a whole different system that can come that is gigantic.
Yeah. How do you think, I know you're very familiar with SWE, and we've chosen to build Alchemy on SWE now. How do you think that stacks up compared to other blockchains? Do you think this is something that is like a SWE-only solution? I mean, we tried to do it on Ethereum for many years. It was just too expensive. I think that the frequency of transactions was too high. So yeah, I'm interested to see how do you think that SWE is uniquely positioned?
You could probably do some of it on Solana, which is performant and good, and you know, the tech's great. But SWE is unique in A, its settlement finality is so short, so it suits itself to these high velocity things. It's incredibly inexpensive, so that's great too. There is liquidity and all the other things, but really SWE built for these big Web 2 applications to turn them into Web 3.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's built for this kind of scale. But then on top of it, what they've done really cleverly, have gone through the internet, looked at the component parts of the internet, and then rebuilt them all from Web3. That's what is incredible about the Mysten Labs team who built Sui. So they built Walrus, decentralized storage layer. Okay, that's very good. And it's a permission database where you can allow certain people with permission. It's it's a smart database. That doesn't exist. You've then got the NFTs that can change over time, and that means contract. An NFT is just a contract, but it's a programmable smart contract that can change with different things. So that becomes very useful when you get into complexities of the industry, like advertising or derivatives or other things like that. Mm-hmm. And the ID side of things, I think, is going to become increasingly important, and the zero knowledge side of what they're building. So they're really thinking through, and then there's the deep book liquidity side. So they're thinking through every part of the stack and then reimagining it from Web3, from Mysten Labs itself, and then saying, hey, build on this. That is very, very unique. It doesn't exist anywhere else. There's no way you can build a soup to nuts or rebuild a business soup to nuts from a Web2 world into a Web3 world without Sui. It just can't happen. You can do parts of it, but you can't do the whole thing.
I think that's the exact reason once we had spoken to the team at Sui. I think there was also like we spoke to a number of layer ones about like moving our infrastructure, because we built our own layer two. We had our own network of validators. What we were struggling was like rolling up the revenue so that we could unlock something like AdFi. And we're not experts in layer ones. We're kind of application layer ad experts. And I think coming from a team that all came from Meta, it's like they uniquely understand the value of like a very efficient advertising model. So I think as soon as we'd spoken to them about it, this is probably something that was on their to-do list to build, and we kind of came to them at the right time. And I think that we feel very privileged to be building it with people that certainly understand the problem in a way that really no other blockchains that I've spoken to.
And the opportunity for you guys as well is to create the infrastructure layer for, there's no point trying to fight and try and win the entire ad market yourselves, but let all the existing players come and build on what you're building. So exactly. Then, networks on top of networks is how this all works. And that's where you accrue real value. Metcalfe's law is based on the fact that it's just the number of nodes in the network plus really the total value transacted of the network. Mm-hmm. If you let people transact in your network becomes immensely valuable. You can be an infrastructure layer and an application layer at the same time.
Exactly that. I think the potential for Move as a language, our team have been on it for 6 months now, just like makes a lot of sense. It was built to transfer value at scale. And I think that fundamentally that is how you would describe the ad market, is the enormous transfer of value at scale around the world. So a network that does that transparently and at very high performance is the obvious solution to what currently exists, which it works, right? Like it's a big market, but like there's certainly improvements that can be made top to bottom.
Well, particularly if there is a lot of economic incentives by both sides of the equation. Forget the people in the middle. Their economic incentive is capturing inefficiencies. But the economic incentive for the advertiser is to get closer from the brand, is to get closer to the consumer. That's vital. And then because the success rate of their advertising dollar goes up, yes, their cost goes up, but they get more sales. And that works really well. If on the other side, it works for the consumer better, then you've really got most of the component parts. Your fight is the people in the middle. And I've gone through this with the music industry. I mean, that is so egregious. Again, 80% of people in the middle. But the problem is everybody has contracts over IP rights and things that can't be taken apart. And everyone's like, well, this is so broken. But when you try and break it down, it can't be changed. So you have to, you can do it with a new artist, but you can't do it with any existing stuff because it's such a goddamn mess. And you're going to have that same fight. It's like everybody doesn't want this to happen except the person who wants to serve the ad and the buyer themselves. And also the platform who accrues that value. But everything else, that can change.
So just a little bit of work for us to do, I think.
It's not easy. It's a very big thing to try and aim for. So, it's a hard thing to do. And, we've seen this with new stock exchanges that came up to make it fairer. We've seen it in a number of different ways. It's a big slog. It's not easy. There's a lot of vested interest that doesn't want it to happen.
Certainly. I think we've seen some joy with large media agencies. I think they help by media at scale. They're very useful for brands that maybe don't have the expertise. But where we've seen a lot of joy is with brands direct. So we've done work with Coca-Cola. They're very interested in the route to their supply, and an immutable record on chain is the perfect solution to that. And then more so, which I'm finding very encouraging, is that as the kind of winds are favoring blockchain and crypto companies these days, they're growing up to some degree in terms of how they think about their marketing. So we've been working with Kraken and Ripple for their brand awareness, and they completely understand our language. And I think that as we move towards a world with like the proliferation of stable coins, you do end up just be able to cut not only players out of like the fee side of things, but just like the velocity of the capital that moves through the market itself. And then there is more ways, particularly with the smart contracts that you can create and the way that you can compose and program money effectively through Sui, to distribute that to people that are creating value. Now that could be the underlying network ourselves. It could be people that have built applications on top of the network now with the Move language. It just, as you say, it kind of stacks.
It's been the same as the banking industry. Is there's a lot of value captured in the transfer of value, and they purposely make it slow so they earn interest.
Yeah.
Stablecoins changes all of that because it's instantaneous. Mm-hmm. And so you don't capture the value in the middle. So there's a different example, which is a really useful example. A friend of mine in Australia used to run treasury and trading at National Australia Bank. And they were building stablecoins. Mm-hmm. I'm like, why are you doing this? He's like, you don't understand. Equities are going to T plus one settlement, so same day settlement, essentially, or next day settlement. He goes, but FX markets are T plus three or T plus two. Everything we do has a foreign currency because we're Australia.
Mm.
Generally speaking, most of our access to the dollar-based system is via the Japanese banks.
Right.
So, and we're in a different time zone to everybody. So sometimes we've got 2, 3, 4 days where we've got hundreds of billions of dollars from the Australian financial system heading itself to the US financial system, and they lose all of the use of that capital.
Yeah.
And they're like, so we're just going to build stable coins because then we can do it instantaneously and get around all of this. Yeah. Where weekends don't matter. That's another thing. Somebody earns the interest over every weekend. People don't realize that. Yeah, you know, they love weekends and bank holidays.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah. And I think particularly when you, I always think about business like Tether, for example, is a brilliant stablecoin business. They have a very, very small team. And I think just because their middle office and their back office must just be so tiny, because a smart contract and a ledger is taking care of what was historically human beings that were putting that information into databases, you name it, right? So I think particularly when agents become even more ubiquitous than they are at the moment, all of a sudden you can just gain significant efficiencies. You can reduce human error insofar as like the movement of capital across even just a business like advertising, right? There's someone in accounts that we have to chase to get an invoice paid. You know, like, that's wasted my time, their time. It eventually arrives. The exchange rates change at that point anyway. Like, there's just so much value leakage from a human being standpoint. And now, like, I am a human being, I'm all for us, but I think there's certainly a ton of very interesting opportunities
there. Once you set up these rails, then agents can work on behalf of brands.
Yep.
To say, find me the most efficient route of doing this. This is what I'm trying to do. It will go out and do that work. Okay, that replaces a lot of agencies in the middle who try and do that. But that is what they can do. And again, it becomes super efficient. It does replace a lot of jobs again, but
yeah, it's one thing that we do. We've built that out internally for ourselves. So like our outreach is automated, our campaign creation and automation is automated. You know, like the way in which bids are optimized is automated now. It's just meant that we can be a leaner, more efficient team, which I think just from a company building standpoint, like
the vibes are better. You know who you're sat opposite. You're not at 2,000 people. So it allows you to scale quite effectively. It allows for the parts of the operation that are centralized for us to keep our cost basis low, which then you're just passing that on, I should say, to people that are using the actual exchange itself to make it as efficient as possible to buy or sell an ad.
Are you finding there's regional differences anywhere? Because you're based in the UK, there's a certain perspective. A lot of the big ad agencies are UK-based and have been, and French, obviously. But basically, a lot of the advertising industry is based out of the UK. It always has been, really. And then there's a bunch of the US ones and Japanese ones, etc. Mm-hmm. Are you seeing different attitudes in different places?
In terms of the adoption of blockchain?
Yeah. What of your ideas? You guys specifically going to talk to people saying this is what we're doing. Do some people care, not care, differences?
It comes down to an individual a lot of the time, actually. So if that individual is interested in blockchain, they want to like lean in really hard. So James at Coca-Cola, for example, is a big blockchain fan. He wanted to know exactly how the ins and outs of it worked. For other people, we're saying more media for the same budget, or for a publisher, it's more revenue for the same ad units. That can be enough. So it's a case by case. I think that we've certainly seen, I think just because of the current administration in the US, people are more excited about the potential of stable coins there. I think it's growing in the UK, so more people are now more interested. To begin with, we barely mentioned it, to be honest with you. That was a mistake we made early doors, was trying to explain why blockchains are brilliant. And actually, it was just you can buy your ads more efficiently. That solves a lot of our problems as far as like finding product market fit. But we're getting more questions now, I will say. And I think then we're fortunate being in London, a lot of European budgets are planned here and then kind of distributed across Europe. So we haven't had much of a foray into Europe yet. And then we're not in Asia at the moment. I'm sure it's a completely different attitude there. But we do deal with Dentsu in the UK. I mean, that is a very large Japanese agency, but it's the UK counterparts.
Interesting.
So it's...
And does the
coming around
funding of the system, is it different in a different region? Is like UK advertising plumbing and the participants within that market, the things that people don't see, is that different to the US? It's all the same players and the same systems.
It's that there are some regional players, but that is actually, I think, one thing that advertising did quite well is that you had different websites with different syntaxes, HTML, where the ad units were created, and there's two very large open source standards. One's called OpenRTB. That's just the way that information is organized when you arrive on a particular page or an app, or you're watching on a TV. There's an IP address, that's the particular website you're on, the ad unit, any cookie data or email address or device ID is then sent. That is all organized via OpenRTB. And then the endpoints are through something called Prebid. So Prebid was effectively built to get around some of the stranglehold that Google had. So Google would just simply prioritize its own demand from its ad server over anything else that you would get. So what the industry created was literally injecting bid prices into the HTML of a website that then overrode anything that Google had within its ad server. It was called header bidding. You had bids in the header of a page. And that was quite transformative for people that weren't Google. And that's how we've been quite successful on onboarding large publications, applications, and connected TV providers onto a blockchain without them necessarily even realizing, because it's just an endpoint. So they call the endpoint, we host an auction on chain, we submit a bid back. If that bid wins, our ad then serves. And what we found is that we win more often than not, because they're taking 40 to 80% off of the price an advertiser is willing to pay. We take 3 to 8%. So we're very competitive in auctions, which means there's less wastage in terms of the amount of server usage that's required, because it's a little known fact that the advertising industry online produces more carbon than the aviation industry does. To kind of give you an idea of how like energy intensive it is to serve a banner ad, you know, it's wild. We're not taking it anywhere. We're just putting videos
on certain websites, but it's quite well organized in that regard. But that was 2016, so there's not really been a huge amount of innovation there. There was a study done by the IAB, which is the body that created OpenRTB and maintains it, that didn't think that blockchains were fast enough to solve for the high frequency trading.
Maybe back then.
No, certainly not. But I think there was a little slight misunderstanding in that your work, the entire trade, even back then, Ethereum was like, what, 5-10 minutes to reconcile a transaction? And that's the main alternative to Bitcoin that could do this. That was the entire transaction that was reconciled. Like, really, to begin with, you only need to have a transparent ledger of what's going on. There's no payment that's being involved at that point. And that's kind of the first step to this all becoming on-chain. So it kind of got a false start in the industry a little bit. I mean, you mentioned Brave. They did a brilliant job of acquiring 10 million users. But I think fundamentally, they are a browser company, and that is quite separate to ad tech to some degree. Chrome is a very different business to DoubleClick for Publishers. You know, like, that's two separate markets that you're looking into there. But again, it's like very technical. There's a ton of smart people that work in advertising. So I think as we continue to grow our revenue and share those fees with people that are producing, contributing resources to the network, we will see, I think, quite a quick adoption, as you see in financial markets, right? It's like nothing, and then like bang, all of a sudden, everyone's like, this is the best idea ever.
Anybody else building on blockchain in your industry?
Not necessarily in the way that we are. I think we're the first ad exchange on Sui. We're the first application of their entire stack because it services enterprises, but no one has approached the problem in the way that we have. You had like Brave at the browser level, you had Veracity that were looking at fraud verification. There's like a growing number of ad networks that are coming out. So you had, I think, Coinbase acquired one. I would say it was called Slides. You have people like Hype Labs that are trying to aggregate blockchain related supply and then just sell that in the way that it had been done. But actually, the undertaking of building an ad exchange is challenging. I can kind of tell you, I didn't look this old 4 years ago. I think I've aged about 10 years. So no, the short answer is no. We're kind of one of the few people, if not the only people, that are currently doing this at the moment. Now, I think that would change. And we just hope they choose to build on Sui using Move in our application versus trying to do all this work that we've done again.
Yeah, exactly right.
So as we... I want to talk to you about the economic singularity. I know that's you love that. How do you see advertising play a role there? Because arguably, it's kind of going against everything I should say, but like, advertising is just evidence of an inefficient market, because if people had 100% of the information that you needed, you wouldn't need advertising. You would just know what you needed to buy, right? Like, how does that fit in with your thesis?
Well, the economic singularity is the breaking apart of the economic system, because the formula for GDP and how economies work is basically population growth plus productivity growth plus debt growth. We have been in a slowing economic world because of aging populations, and we've offset that by debt. Now, we're in a death spiral. Until something changes. So we just keep refinancing the debt and hoping it goes away, and we don't get enough growth. So then the debt keeps going up, debt to GDP keeps going up. Mm-hmm. And eventually you're about to throw in infinite new workers into the system.
Yeah.
Which is AI and robots.
Mm-hmm.
So then suddenly GDP growth can go to 20% a year globally.
Mm.
Who does that accrue to? How does it accrue? What does it mean for us? What does it mean for our jobs? When AI comes, it makes a lot of work. Even me, my macro research, or even me online, because I can use AI, I'm already using AI.
Yeah.
You know, people don't understand the whole scale disruption of what is coming. So how do we become economic participants in the new system? Well, blockchain shows some of the way of that, because you can participate in a network by owning a token. If the network gets used a lot, you make money from that network. If you work for that network, you're giving your attention, you might get some tokens, which was the idea that Brave tested.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Okay, very good test. Interesting test. Mm-hmm. Humans are still driven by status
mm-hmm.
and aspiration.
maybe some of the needs-based stuff goes away because your agent figures out what you need in a fridge and it'll go and do it.
Yeah.
But does, so then is there a battle of another agent from Unilever versus Procter & Gamble saying, actually buy my product and I'll give you a whatever? We don't know. That battle of agent to agent is going to be interesting. And we don't care because it just get delivered by a drone to our house or whatever it is.
Or a
robo vehicle to our house.
Yeah.
But at the luxury end, when I think about what can humans do in this new world, because everyone gets all doomy about it. We're all going to be at home, you know, in the metaverse with nothing to do. I'm like, the thing that humans can do that the machines will never be able to do ever is be human.
Yeah.
Right. That's why, you know, I think it's not stupid that all of these billionaires be buy sports teams.
Yeah.
Can we construct a better football player but with a robot eventually? For sure. Will we watch that? Less likely.
Yeah.
Look at chess. Chess is a big industry.
Mm-hmm.
Where the machines are better than humans for about 25 years. Yet we watch humans to humans play chess.
Yeah.
You know, can a machine beat a wrestler, a boxer? Of course. But we will watch human to human. So anything human is of value, and advertisers will figure out how to do that. And that's not going to be from the AI. It's just some human element. I think there was a very important part of capturing in real life events is online.
Yeah.
That's going to be the value prop. And this is where I think ticketing unlocks it. Something I've been looking at for a while is anybody who owns a ticket is attending a real in real life event, and it gives a social graph and information that the internet captures, but in real life does not capture.
Yeah.
That can then be served to advertisers.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's something there as well. So it's just, it is going to change at scale. In some ways it'll get more efficient. In other ways it'll be more premium.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's,
and we need the in it. We need money because, you know, I don't believe necessarily in universal basic income is the outcome partially. Universal basic equity is actually the outcome, which is this idea that you can participate by having an economic stake in the networks that you belong in.
Yeah, okay.
You participate in.
The point you made about events is very interesting. I went to see Oasis 2 weeks ago, which was...
So jealous.
It was probably, as such a cliche, but like probably one of the best gigs I've been to. Like everyone was having a good time. It was in Manchester. It was 32 degrees. And I went with some Americans and they're like, we want to move to Manchester. I'm like, do not be fooled. This is probably like in the top 20 days in Manchester ever. They're like, it's so nice. I'm like, yeah, no, it is today. But I think if you, let's say that you had put on Eventbrite, you were attending that and it was run on any events page, I think like the manufacturers of bucket hats would probably want to show you an ad shortly after you visited that gig, because I've never seen so many bucket hats in one place at one point, I think. So certainly well, that.
You know, Ticketmaster, just think of the scale of what they do.
Yeah.
Now, there's a lot. The ticket industry is exactly the same as the ad industry. There's so much extraction and backroom dealing. It's a pretty awful business. But the social graph of tickets is incredible.
Yeah.
It's, because it's in real life connection, which is why Google have a Nest in my house.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're capturing me. Because what do you do when you come into your house? You put your phone down.
Yeah.
Right. So now they can't track you because they don't know where you are.
Mm-hmm.
Or Apple, but the moment you install any of their technology, they're like, "Oh, why the hell do they want a thermostat for your house for Google?"
Yeah,
it's because they're capturing in real life data.
Absolutely, yeah, tying IP addresses together so that they know you're you. Like they've tied your Nest to your phone, and so they can now sell your any website that you visit anywhere. Now they still know that you're you and can send you a message and deliver. They did have a performance, right? I think they're the biggest company in the world. It's remiss of me to say that they're not good at what they do.
They're geniuses. I mean, they're too smart that people don't even realize, you know, why do they buy Roomba? Everyone's like, well, why the fuck do they buy a vacuum cleaning company?
Mm.
I'm like, no. That thing is mapping your house.
Yeah,
they know the dimensions of your house. Therefore, how wealthy somebody is, because you've got the geolocation. Oh, so that's in Mayfair and it's a 5,000 square meter of square foot house, well, this person is probably worth, you know, $300 million. It's like, there's so much information with, particularly now with even more advanced AI, but just basic number crunching that you can figure out from this stuff.
I agree. And I think that one thing that we spend a lot of time thinking about, and this is something, again, it's not reinventing the wheel, this is still done with TV, is that a lot of TV is still sold via upfronts. And that's never really translated to digital ad industry, digital ad inventory, I should say, as such. And I think that a blockchain for the first time kind of creates the proof that you would need to create a futures market of some degree, whereby, let's say I came to you and said, look, I'll buy the ad inventory on Real Vision for the next year. And because I know it's going to exist at some point in the future, I can then try and add some value to it in a way I would like to sell it. That then means that you're getting now paid up front. That means that you can then create more content. So then you have more options to sell in the future. You know, I think that
it's a great
really idea. Once we kind of lay the framework for, okay, you can trade ads at scale on chain, the way in which that you can price and sell inventory is going to become much closer to financial markets. You know, I just finished reading a book called The Renaissance, or The Reminiscence of a Stock Operator, which is a guy in like 1912.
Edwin Lefebvre, yeah, it's famous.
That's right, yeah. And it's so, it's very similar to what I think crypto markets are like today. So that was interesting from that degree. But then it's also very similar to the way that ad markets are. You know? So it's like, it's interesting that piece of history. You can learn from where financial markets have come. It's just, there needs to be something that ties it all together. And I think that we've...
So here's a question for you. I mean, I don't watch television at all. I watch a bit of Netflix now and then, or Apple TV or whatever. I don't watch television at all. I was in Spain on holiday and it was UK TV in the and I'm like, it's so awful. And it's all the advertising is for baby boomers because they're the only people who watch TV.
Yeah.
So it's all kind of after death planning and drug companies, and the US is even worse. You just see that, and you can see it's literally a dying market.
Yeah.
I just can't see how that exists any longer, or much longer.
I think, so we deal with a lot of broadcasters, and there's been a heavy push to AVOD. So like Netflix has a tier now where you pay slightly less and they'll show you some ads. The difficulty has been that businesses get into ads and don't always nail it. So like Netflix chose to work with one technology company that didn't work out, and I'll move that in-house. But I disagree with you to some point, because I think there is a world in which the search ad inventory disappears, traditional display ad inventory disappears.
Well, because all of AI is going to collapse a lot of the UI of the UX of the internet.
Exactly right.
That's
so nice. But I still think people will watch TV. I think and just video, right? I think that's it. TV is kind of the device that seems to be a way to describe it.
Broadcast versus on demand is two different worlds, right? It's broadcast TV that's still baby boomer driven.
100%. Yeah.
It's in the death spiral. It's the same as, you know, different media have been in the past.
Exactly right. But I think the advertising video on demand, streaming video, I think that to some degree is LLM proof. In that, like, you would still, and the same with in-app inventory, like people love playing games on their phones. You can't really do that with an LLM in their way they exist today. And I think that will continue to exist until like the next bit of hardware. Maybe it'll be Johnny Ive and OpenAI that just got changed the paradigm. So I don't think we've had like a paradigm shifting bit of hardware since the mobile phone. We're probably due. I wish I knew what it was, but
I mean, I think the glasses form factor seems to be where everybody's bet is going.
Yes.
And then the next edge from that is the Neuralink.
Yeah, true.
So we've kind of got the idea, and whether we don't know what Johnny Ive is trying to do, whether it's some sort of device that is your personal AI at any point, or whether you integrate it with a form factor like glasses. But it's a weird world. Every single person wears a pair of glasses.
It is, yeah. And I hope it's not some kind of souped up brooch that you wear on your blazer, you know, that you kind of like tap Star Trek style. I hope it's a little bit more exciting than that. But yeah, I think particularly when you think about, because let's go back to the TV point, even when you're watching like ITV play on your TV, like that is technically like broadcasted, but delivered slightly differently. As wallets become interesting, so like you log in to pay your ITV subscription or your Sky or whoever your provider is with a wallet, as opposed to, I mean, let's take Sweet, you can just abstract it away. It's your email address that has a wallet attached to it because you created it on the Sweet network. That then follows you around to some degree. You have a very interesting way for like providing attribution to TV that you get with digital ads. Like you can track someone from their link that they clicked an ad to all the way through to purchase. Like that chain is broken to some degree with when you watch a TV ad. But once you tie a wallet back into it and you watch something on TV and then you check out on your phone and it's still the same email address attached to that wallet, you can now attribute the value and performance to TV, and it moves into a different part of the funnel, which I think is quite interesting.
Yeah, but I also think TV is about to go through a change. I mean, I'm working hard on and should be able to launch soon an AI chatbot of me, which I've already got the voice version that's on Real Vision in my voice, trained on my stuff, and it's going to be video.
Mm.
It's going to talk to me. And okay, at first it's going to seem like a gimmick, and then everybody's going to realize the entire media industry is going to go from one to many to one to one. And everybody's experience is different. Yes, we want shared experiences, hence football's going to an Oasis gig, shared human experience. You want to talk about the new series on Netflix. I get it.
Yeah.
But also, reality is most of this is going to go to one to one. So the whole media industry changes. But again, that doesn't exclude advertising. In fact, it gets better. The experience, and it understands me better. So, I mean, there's so much change coming. I don't know how people are going
to... I agree. It's funny you say that, because like, I think a lot of people will say that advertising doesn't work. And now this isn't my quote, but I think it's a brilliant one. It's like, no one believes that it works until you lose your pet and then you put a sign on a lamppost and then someone calls you and says, oh, I found your cat who was walking around the garden. We've had it. I scanned the chip and now he's home again. And I think when you get the right message to the right person at exactly the right time, you're like, oh, it's actually useful. I needed a broom mop. I just ordered some squeegees for my windows in my flat. So I needed that because my windows were dirty, right? So like when the messaging is right, it's not
Feeling. Imagine secondhand cars, right? They have to go through a centralized thing, or you put in a newspaper and hope somebody spots it, right?
Yeah.
So I'm trying to sell a car. Now, if I could make that ad inventory, that automatically goes onto a network and delivers me a buyer, and out of that exchange comes value to whoever. Okay, that's super disruptive.
Yeah, certainly.
Because that's one-to-one ability to serve exactly what I need to exactly the person who's looking for the same car.
Yeah, it's not even necessarily like advertising then in that example. It's purely like market making, really. So, I mean, you're
isn't advertising just market making, really?
Yeah.
I've got some goods and I'm trying to find a buyer. That's all it is. Mm.
It's not as efficient as it should be. I think is probably the theme that we've had throughout this conversation, is that there's a lot of efficiencies that can be added everywhere.
And that's why I'm just super interested in what you're building. I just think it's a very big idea. It's a very important idea. And it's hard as well. But if you get it, if you crack it, it's big.
I think it's certainly, I've always felt very bullish. You know, I think I'm probably too stubborn for this not to work out. And I think that it certainly feels like we have a better path to success with working with the Niston Labs team. I think just... they've solved much larger problems at scales I probably can't imagine when they worked at Meta. And I think that being able to use that technology to deliver a marketplace that's more efficient in terms of fees, but then also a ways for anyone with liquidity to generate yield from the OPEX of the internet, in effect, is something that I think is easier to understand. And I think often I come from a point where I have to explain ad tech to some people, but then you have the hook in that you've probably seen an ad today. So you've been exposed to the market to some degree, and now it's a chance to generate some yield from that exposure that perhaps you couldn't have done in the past unless you built yourself an ad exchange or you were Google or Meta in the first place.
Exactly.
All right, Ral, I think it's probably quite a nice place to wrap things up.
I think we went quite broad, quite deep there. So I think
hopefully... Yeah, it was good. Thank you so much for the time. I really appreciate it. And I hope
not at all. I enjoyed it. It's a very different discussion. So I loved it. Thank you.
Awesome. Cheers, Ral.